Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about The Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on circumcision right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about these budding young lawyers coming out of law school. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that," he said. "Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax." That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, call direct 417-273-4967 or go to the webpage. Send me an email, georgegordon.org. Well, there's a subject here called circumcision that just generates so much hate and discontent among religious people that it's almost like being sacrilegious. One side says all children should be circumcised, which, by the way, here in America, most children are circumcised. And then there's another group that is just lobbying intensely to have circumcision abolished and done away with. Well, Richard W. Morris is an attorney. And Richard Morris wrote an article called "A New Area of Liability for Physicians, Hospitals, and Patients Concerning Circumcision." Listen to what Mr. Morris has to say. He starts off by saying, "Every person who unlawfully and maliciously deprives a human being of a member of his body or disables, disfigures, or renders it useless, or cuts or slits the tongue, or puts out an eye, or slits the nose, ear, or lip, is guilty of mayhem." So says the California Civil Code. Well, there are, of course, situations in which consent eliminates criminality from acts which would otherwise constitute assault, battery, or even mayhem, such as consent given for a surgical procedure which is for the benefit of the patient. Such consent by the individual, let alone the parent, would be invalid for the slitting of the tongue, slitting the nose, slitting the ear or lip, if such act were not for the benefit of the patient. Certainly, if the patient were not in a position to consent, the act would be mayhem or worse, and battery at best. In any case, it's a crime. Now, can you imagine a doctor's defense to the charge of mayhem by cutting a split in the nose of a newborn child, being that it would keep the nose cleaner, or slicing the child's ear so the Q-tips would fit better? No time would be lost in suing the good doctor. How then does the picture change when a day or so after birth, a doctor takes a 6-pound bundle of humanity into a dark room where the baby screams cannot be heard by its parents, straps this little guy's legs and arms apart in a spread eagle position on a torture called circumstraint, uses no anesthetic, picks up a scalpel, and begins the only out-and-out act of torture performed by American physicians. That's the way the article begins. Sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? I was circumcised when I was 8 days old. And I was so young, I can't remember how bad it must have felt. I mean, we like to think in terms of, my God, that must really hurt. Now, when people are adults, I remember I ran across a guy one time. He was about 40 years old, and he was circumcised. O'Verne told me, he said, well, it hurt pretty bad for a couple of weeks, and he had anesthetic and the whole nine yards, you know, and they did it in the hospital and on an outpatient basis. He went in, had it done, and then he went home same day. It wasn't that he stayed in the hospital any length of time, but, you know, when an adult male gets circumcised, it's quite a deal. Millions of babies are circumcised every year, worldwide, of course, and almost all Jewish babies, and I suspect here in the United States, I forgot the numbers, we'll probably see them here in a minute, that deal with circumcision, it's well over half of American babies are circumcised. And of course, this author and a number of other authors, a number of other Christians and ministers, are totally opposed to circumcision. Well, if these Christian ministers, if these Christians are opposed to circumcision, why do we do it? Where did the custom come from? Well, he's got a little bit more to say. Morris said this. He said, the only way to truly fight this battle against child abuse is to show that it all started with the Bible, the Old Testament part, the part that Christ and Paul asked us not to slide back into. Now, you judge for yourself if continuing on with child abuse is going to offer salvation to the life hereafter. He said, I do not believe that God made a mistake when he created man. I think he knew exactly what he was doing when he gave all men a foreskin. He made our bodies complete because that's the way he wanted us to be. And I thank God that my parents were Christian enough to leave me alone when I was a baby. And he said, finally, no human being should be forced into this because there are no medical reasons for this amputation. So I plead with you to join in partnership with us to help wipe out this unchristian act. Let's take some of the hell out of living for everyone so they will be happy to be alive. Now that was Richard W. Morris. He said there's no medical reason for circumcision. Is that really true? And why do we have circumcision in the Bible if it's been abolished in the New Testament? Does the New Testament abolish laws that are created in the Old Testament? If circumcision was good for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and all of the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, when did circumcision become bad? if there's no medical reason for it, then why are we doing it at all? Has anybody ever looked into the Bible to find out? Has anybody ever looked into medical science to find out, are there any medical reasons? So let's take up the subject of medical reasons for circumcision. Let's see. Circumventing cancer with circumspect circumcision. This is an article written by a doctor, just like Richard W. Morris is an attorney at law. Here's a doctor that deals in medicine, and here's what he had to say. 42-year-old Jack Schmidt shifted his weight nervously on the examining room table as I washed my hands. "Well, what brings you here?" I asked. I had noticed that he had not come to see me in over 5 years. "Well, Doc," he said, "I've got this lump that I guess you should take a look at. It's probably nothing, but I've been getting kind of worried about it." Jack proceeded to show me a golf ball-sized tumor that looked something like a small head of cauliflower with a large cratered ulcer in the middle. "How long have you had this?" I asked. Several weeks, at least. I said, "How about 6 months, Jack?" And Jack looked startled. He said, "Yeah, I guess. How'd you know, Doc?" Well, the next day, we admitted Jack to the hospital, and as I had guessed, the pathologist diagnosed the surgical sample of his tumor to be squamous cell carcinoma of the penis with metastasis to the lymph nodes of the groin. When I broke the news to Jack, he covered his face with his hands and he sobbed, "Why me? Why Jack?" Well, why Jack? Well, he had waited too long to get any help from the medical profession. He had seen me 6 months earlier, or had he seen me 6 months earlier, while the cancer was still localized, his treatment would have resulted almost certainly in a cure. But at this late stage, we could offer him very little hope, and studies have shown that over one-third of the victims of this cancer put off seeking treatment until their cancer has reached an incurable state. Now, despite radical surgery and the removal of the penis and the lymph nodes of the groin, Jack died about 2 years later, leaving behind rather two boys and their mother. Now, what makes this death even more tragic is the fact that medical science has now proved that cancer of the penis is almost entirely preventable by following an instruction that God gave to Abraham more than 4,000 years ago. The history of this recognition is intriguing. In 1932, Dr. A.L. Wolbarst of New York reviewed the records of 1,103 cases of cancer of the penis. Among all of these cases, there was not even one Jew. Indeed, cancer of the penis is so astoundingly rare among Jews that its very occurrence warrants publication in a medical journal. Since Dr. Wolbarst's study, only 6 cases of such cancers in Jews have ever been reported in the United States. Now, why are Jewish men almost entirely free of this lethal cancer? Medical researchers have found that this spectacular freedom results from the practice of circumcision instituted by God over 4,000 years ago. Jewish men are not the only men immune to this disease. Researchers have found that any man circumcised in infancy will also enjoy this immunity. In 3 large studies covering 521 cases of cancer of the penis, not a single circumcised man was found. What makes this statistic even more startling is the finding that in the age group at risk for this cancer, which is about one half of men, were circumcised. Thus, one would have expected about 260 cases, that is, half of 521, to occur in men who were circumcised. Instead, they found none. Now, from India comes another convincing study. In India, there are four major religious groups: Hindus, Christians, Parsis, and Muslims. Muslims circumcise their sons between the ages of 3 and 12 years, but none of the other groups practice circumcision. Among the Hindus, Christian, and Parsi men, cancers of the penis make up 330 out of every 10,000 cancers. But among circumcised Muslims, only 15 out of 10,000 cancers are diagnosed as cancer of the penis. The cause for most of these 15 cancers is probably the Muslim practice of delaying circumcision until a boy is several years old. Although cancer of the penis is fairly rare in the United States, the actual rate of this cancer in uncircumcised men is about 1 in every 600. So, if none of the 1.8 million American boys born each year were circumcised, one would expect about 3,000 of these boys to have penile cancer during their lifetimes, and about 1,000 of them would die from this disease. Well then, how does circumcision protect men from penile cancer? Most experts feel that these cancers are caused by smegma, spelled S-M-E-G-M-A, smegma, a filthy and foul-smelling paste of bacteria and dead cells trapped under the foreskin. By circumcision, circum meaning around, and scission cutting, the foreskin is removed, eliminating the small pouch on the end of the penis where smegma accumulates. The American Academy of Pediatrics states circumcision properly performed eliminates much of the need for careful penile hygiene. If circumcision is not elected, however, the necessity for lifelong penile hygiene should be discussed with the parents. Routine retraction of the foreskin and careful cleansing of the penile head would cleanse the penis of smegma and theoretically eliminate the risk of penile cancer. Thus, the American Academy of Pediatrics holds that there are no valid medical indications for circumcision in the neonatal period. Now, this recommendation, however, is based on the erroneous assumption that if you tell a boy to wash something, that he will wash it. Now, most parents, and particularly mothers, have had the exasperating experience of repeatedly sending a son to the bathroom to wash behind his ears. In fact, one study found that only 1 out of 4 uncircumcised teenage boys who had a retractable foreskin actually practiced personal penile hygiene. In recent years, a tremendous amount of debate about the pros and cons of circumcision has appeared in medical journals. Articles entitled "Penile Plunder" and "The Rape of the Phallus" underscore the emotional opposition of some physicians. Others have pointed to the origins of the anti-circumcision movement as growing out of guilt-induced anxiety, leading to a fear of genital injury, and they further state that the catalytic element for the anti-circumcision swell lies in the current aura of protest. Movements abound to save wild horses, to save polar bears, to save islands and lakes. The establishment is seen as a universally bad guy. In this atmosphere, the male infant is easily and emotionally envisioned as helpless and unmarred, as indeed he is. Now, the literature of the anti-circumcision crusade has recently received the edition of a book by Edward Wallerstern. Although Mr. Wallerstern refers to over 450 different authors, he fails to quote any of the statistics that I have just mentioned regarding penile carcinoma. Instead, Mr. Wallerstein reasons, the argument that carcinoma of the penis will be prevented by circumcision is hardly valid, for there are cases of this disease in circumcised males. However, it is his reasoning that is invalid. You see, medical literature finds penile carcinoma to be extremely rare, but not non-existent in circumcised males. His statement is analogous to saying that since men die, however rarely, from breast cancer, men are not protected from this disease of breast cancer. Or, since non-smokers may die, however rarely, from lung cancer, they are not protected from this cancer by not smoking. The fact is that even in the United States, uncircumcised men have well over a 100-fold greater risk of penile carcinoma. Some doctors who recognize that circumcision prevents penile cancer point out that circumcision is surgery, so it involves a certain amount of risk. Now, the largest study to date of the risk of circumcision found that in 500,000 newborn circumcisions, only one death, which occurred after a ritual circumcision in a home and was complicated by a delay in obtaining a transfusion. If these 500,000 newborns had not been circumcised, about 830 of them would have come down with penile carcinoma, and 275 of them would have died from this disease. The statistics speak for themselves. Now, if we have these statistics in the United States, where most people practice daily bathing of their bodies, can you imagine the problem in more primitive cultures where washing the body, let alone the head of the penis, is an extremely rare event, and where penile cancer is invariably fatal? While I worked in Africa, I was appalled at the high prevalence of lethal penile cancer among the uncircumcised nationals. In fact, penile cancer makes up 18% of the male cancers in China, a land of poor hygiene and uncircumcised males. To such a people, the nomadic household of Abraham, God gave the command to circumcise every male. Even the most adamant opponents of circumcision recognize that this procedure is necessary for many boys who cannot retract their foreskin. Circumcision facilitates cleanliness by eliminating the need for scrupulous penile hygiene. In Canada, where only 50% of newborns are circumcised, over 10,000 therapeutic circumcisions are performed on boys who have passed infancy. For these surgeries, the boys are put to sleep under general anesthesia, which carries with it a risk of death of about 1 in 10,000. Thus, one would expect about one Canadian boy per year to die from therapeutic circumcision. However, if all of the 90,000 uncircumcised boys had been circumcised as infants, an average of over 5 years would have passed between deaths from these circumcisions. Serious risk remains even if the doctor performs the surgery by numbing the area with a local anesthetic. Recently, two doctors reported two young men who became permanently impotent following circumcision with a local anesthetic. Also, these circumcisions done on older boys and men have much more expensive or were much more expensive than infant circumcisions due to additional hospital stays, doctor costs, and work loss. One author has estimated that if all Canadian boys were circumcised as infants, it would result in a savings of over $18 million a year. Thus we see that routine infant circumcision is in fact cost-effective, and it prevents deaths from penile cancer and from delayed surgery. After many laborious years of study, medical science has demonstrated the most effective way for preventing the deadly squamous cell carcinoma of the penis. Science did not arrive at this conclusion because of any laboratory steam that it had generated. Rather, it was carried forward by a long train of statistics that existed only because many generations of Jews and Muslims had faithfully followed the command that God gave to their father, Abraham. Now, in the first edition of this book, I cited the evidence that cancer of the uterine, that is, the female cervix, the tip of the uterus that caps off the vagina, was primarily a disease of sexual partners of uncircumcised males. In the intervening years, however, cervical cancer has been more firmly related to multiple sexual partners. One study of the death certificates of 13,000 celibate nuns did not turn up even a single cancer of the cervix. Now, a recent study found evidence of venereal wart viruses in 73 out of 80 women who had cervical cancer. Thus, it seems that cervical cancer is, for the most part, a result of venereal disease, and therefore following biblical moral principles would probably wipe out this, a very common cancer. Now, one night while I was in Africa, the chief of a local tribe awakened me and asked me to perform a circumcision on his 12-year-old son. I did the procedure in the operating room, and the chief requested that I tell no one about this clandestine surgery. And for my payment, he invited me to attend the ritual circumcision for the rest of the site, or for the rest of the 12-year-old boys in the tribe. 2 weeks later, I arrived at the site for the ritual circumcision. For several hours, the 12-year-old boys threw eerie shadows as they danced around a large bonfire. Then they lined up against a fence with a large butcher knife in hand, the witch doctor, his body painted in orange and red, and his face covered with a grotesque wooden mask, approached the trembling boys. Suddenly, he grasped the foreskin of the first boy in line, leaped 3 feet into the air, shrieked a cry of terrifying vengeance, and severed the foreskin from the unsuspecting boy. He repeated this procedure on the rest of the boys. With the chief's son, he then entered a small hut where he repeated the sound effects, but not the procedure. While all of the other boys were moaning in excruciating pain, the chief's son exited the hut defiantly. He jumped on a donkey, and he rode into the village, whereupon all of the members of the tribe recognized the superior character of the heir to the chieftain. So what about the pain? Well, no one would deny that circumcision is a painful experience, but the amount of pain suffered as related to the age of the male being circumcised. The most careful study of this matter was conducted by Dr. Joseph Katz, and in infants up to 3 weeks old, he observed pain and irritability only at the immediate time of surgery. However, infants from 4 weeks to 3 months old were still irritable during the night following surgery. Children between 3 months to 1 year were irritable for 3 or 4 days, and adults suffered pain and discomfort for at least 1 week. Moreover, circumcisions done on older boys or adults also carry the psychological trauma of removing a private part of their bodies. For example, one study found that boys circumcised between the ages of 4 and 7 viewed the operation as an attack on their bodies, and this procedure resulted in the cases, or in an increase rather, in the aggressive emotions even several days after surgery. Even thinking about the procedure produces discomfort in most men. Well, let's take a break right here. We're talking about circumcision. What are the medical advantages or benefits that come from circumcision? Most of the people who are opposed to circumcision adamantly say that there is absolutely no medical benefit, so therefore it's mayhem or it's child abuse. Well, here's a doctor that went to the statistics and says, no, not so. That among circumcised males, penile cancer is practically unheard of, and their sex partners, their wives, cervical cancer is nearly unheard of. Could it be that God did in fact know what he was doing when he instituted circumcision? Hang on, we'll be back with more right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the law school, or the law hour rather, is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the internet. For more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about circumcision. We began with a treatise by Richard W. Morris. He's an attorney. He says that circumcision is mayhem. Circumcision is child abuse. And it ought to be outlawed. It ought to be abolished. Many doctors subscribe to that view, many lawyers, many Christians, many religious people, and indeed many non-religious people subscribe to that view. So I thought, well, I'd share with you the medical statistics that go along with circumcision. We find that in China, where circumcision is not practiced, 18% of male cancers are penile cancer. Among Jews, it's practically unheard of, and among Muslims, it is extremely rare for Muslim males to come down with penile cancer, and for their wives to have cervical cancer. Those are the statistics. Those are the facts. Is there a medical advantage? Yes, there is. Well, then, why do all of these doctors and these Christians and these religious people, why are they so adamantly opposed to circumcision since it was originated by God in the Scripture? Now, this doctor goes on and he says, Thus, the least physically and psychologically traumatic time to circumcise a male child is sometime during the first few days of life. So does it make any difference what day is chosen within these first few days? In a pediatric journal, we read, the greatest risk of hemorrhaging occurs between 2 and 7 days of life. A pediatric textbook elaborates, hemorrhages at this time, though often inconsequential, are sometimes extensive. They may produce serious damage to internal organs, especially to the brain, and cause death from shock. Now, at birth, the baby's intestines contain no bacteria. Between the 5th and the 7th day of life, these bacteria begin to proliferate and produce the important vitamin, vitamin K. This vitamin K goes to the liver, where it plays an important part in forming 4 different clotting proteins. And if any one of these clotting proteins is missing, serious bleeding may result. In most normal babies, blood levels of all 4 proteins decrease quickly after birth because infants are vitamin K deficient. Today, however, doctors boost the infant's clotting system by giving newborn babies shots of vitamin K. Thus, medical science has eliminated this potentially serious bleeding disorder altogether. One of the proteins dependent on vitamin K is called prothrombin. The following graph, based on data collected before the era of routine vitamin K shots, shows that by the 3rd day of the baby's life, the available prothrombin is about 30% of normal. By the 8th day, however, we see that the available prothrombin skyrockets to 110% of the adult level, and it soon levels off to a normal 100%. So an average 8-day-old baby has more available prothrombin than on any other day of his life. Thus, the safest day in a male's entire life to perform a circumcision is on the 8th day. Now, in the Bible, you were instructed that you're to circumcise the child on the 8th day. Jesus was taken in and circumcised on the 8th day. Throughout the scripture, you'll see that term, the 8th day. Very common. Over and over again, we see that in the Bible. Again, medical science verifies the medical accuracy of the Bible. Now, I was circumcised on the 8th day. Jewish children are circumcised on the 8th day. You'll notice here in the article by Richard W. Morris, he says on the 2nd or 3rd day, babies are taken in, strapped down, and circumcised. Well, even though they're circumcised, they're being circumcised on the wrong day of the week. It should be on the 8th day after the child is born, because the child has the highest level of vitamin K that he's going to have in his lifetime. So again, not only did God instruct us to circumcise our male children, but he also instructed us to circumcise them on the 8th day, which is the safest day to do it. Well, at birth, the baby's intestines contain no bacteria. This is why that colostrum, the first milk that comes from a cow or a ewe or a mother, is so important to a baby, so important to that child, that calf, that newborn, because it creates the bacteria, which then creates the vitamin K, so that on the 8th day, the circumcision can be done, and it can be done safely. Now, we should commend the many hundreds, or commend rather, the many hundreds of workers who labored at great expense over a number of years and found that the safest day to perform circumcision is the eighth day. Yet as we congratulate medical science, we almost hear the pages of the Bible rustling when we turn to Genesis 17, verse 12, where we read God's words to Abraham. And let me see if I got the page here correctly. 90, 91. I don't know what happened here, but I've lost my place. I'm on page 92 here. We should commend the many hundreds of workers who labored at great expense. You ever notice that medical science takes the credit? If you stop and think about it, medical science takes a lot of credit. You know, when they find some new medical procedure. I remember reading about washing of the hands. That was quite a little story. Remember, they were killing a lot of women, especially in the pediatric wards of hospitals before the turn of the century. And then one doctor woke up one day and he said, "You know, we're going around here, we're touching patients that have diseases, and then we walk in here to the pediatric ward and we touch women, we don't wash our hands." They started washing their hands, and the guy that came up with the idea was ostracized from medicine. I mean, they came down on him like a ton of bricks. And then today, when doctors go into surgery, they lather up and they wash their hands and arms and one thing and another. It's like a religious ritual to watch a doctor washing his hands. And now, on this eighth day over here, medical science comes along and says, "Gee, we discovered that the highest level of vitamin K occurs on the eighth day." Keep in mind that it was the Bible more than 3,000 years ago that instructed us to use that eighth day. All right, here's page 93. "Every male among you," this is the Bible now, instructing Abraham, "every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised." So Abraham did not pick the eighth day after many centuries of trial and error experiments, although many modern physicians think otherwise. For example, we read in a 1982 edition of the Cecil Textbook of Medicine, "The vitamin K deficient state lasts for 3 to 5 days and may be the reason why the Israelites did not circumcise their babies until the eighth day. However, in babies who are not given vitamin K shots, only 1 in 200 to 400 babies suffers a bleeding disorder. Thus, in order to determine that the eighth day was the safest day to circumcise, the Hebrews, a primitive, nomadic, desert-dwelling people, would have had to conduct immense, carefully designed experiments, including thousands of circumcisions performed on each day of the newborn's lives. Why not accept the Bible statement that it was God who spoke to Abraham and gave him that instruction?" Well, neither Abraham nor any of his company from the ancient city of Ur in the Chaldees had ever been circumcised, and although some of the Middle Eastern peoples did practice circumcision, historians feel that infant circumcision was unique to the Israelites. Thus, the eighth day was not picked by some genius in statistical analysis, but by the creator of the universe, the creator of vitamin K. And although it is often thought that Jewish circumcision was instituted for health reasons, there is no evidence to support this view. Moses, the famous, in this case, Moses Maimonides, not the Moses of the Book of Exodus, but the famous 12th century Jewish physician, stated, "No one, however, should circumcise himself or his son for any other reason but pure faith." This is also the position of modern Orthodox rabbis, such as Eric Isaac, who said, "The Orthodox Jewish community is intent on affirming the strictly religious character of circumcision and thus on eliminating the medical aura surrounding the practice. Even a modern-day physician, Dr. Joseph Miller, has written, 'Many people today believe that circumcision is primarily a health measure. This is not the fact. Circumcision is the symbol of the covenant between God and the Jewish nation.'" Using these and other quotes, Mr. Edward Wallerstein has scolded me for agreeing with those modern physicians who not only accept the literal interpretation of the Bible, but also interpose their own health beliefs. In 1970, Dr. S.I. McMillan wrote, quote, "Medical researchers agree that freedom from diseases results from circumcision, which God ordered Abraham to institute 4,000 years ago. While I grant him that God may have had other reasons than the health of his people in mind when he instituted circumcision, but the fact remains that the ancient Hebrews, whether they knew it or not, gained health benefits from following God's command to be circumcised, just as washing and separation after touching the dead was practiced solely because this was a command of God, so the Hebrews followed God's command concerning circumcision as well. Now, this is true of all of God's commandments. If we obey them, even if we do not know the specific reason for this command or commandment, we will then reap temporal and eternal benefits from practicing those laws. The inspiration of the biblical account becomes even more obvious when we take a look at the changes that the Jews made in the circumcision ritual over the years. During the few centuries preceding Christ, the Jews, or rather the Greeks, attempted to convert Jews to paganism. These converts blistered the remainder of their foreskins. The resulting scar tissue formed an artificial foreskin, thus obliterating the appearance of circumcision. In order to prevent this practice, the ritual circumcision surgeon ripped away all of the remaining foreskin with his sharpened fingernails. The resulting ragged, filthy wound ensured a high rate of infection. By the 7th century AD, many Jews added a second change to this ritual. In addition to scraping with his fingernails, the ritual surgeon moistened his lips with wine, placed the infant's penis in his mouth, and sucked the blood from the ragged wound. Even the great Jewish physician Maimonides staunchly supported this procedure as a prophylactic measure against inflammation. The mouth is a perfect medium for growing bacteria, however, so this procedure increased the frequency and the severity of inflammation from infections. Today, in backward Israeli villages, fatal cases of gangrene, tuberculosis, and tetanus still result from this filthy ritual. In order to save one boy, doctors had to amputate the infant's penis. Now, why don't modern scientists give us some explanation for the empirical origins of these disease-producing rituals? Why don't they note the careful observations that the Jews must have made in order to come up with these deadly practices? The answer is very simple. Like almost all health rituals of primitive peoples, these rituals are based on whimsical superstition, not on scientific observation or on the commands of Almighty God. So they inevitably have serious and deleterious effects. Now, God stated that circumcision was to be done with flint knives in Joshua 5, verse 2. Flint knives, not sharpened fingernails. And God simply commanded that the foreskins be cut off with these knives. Scraping with sharpened fingernails or sucking with a filthy mouth were man's additions. The use of this particular knife is also interesting because in sharpening a flint knife, one chips away at the stone until one has a sharp edge, thus exposing new uncontaminated stone. Thus, a newly sharpened flint knife is practically sterile. Now, isn't it interesting that Moses did not specify one of the common Egyptian ointments containing animal dung in order to speed up the healing? As circumcision symbolized God's old covenant with the children of Abraham, so circumcision symbolizes God's new covenant with the believers in Jesus. This circumcision of the new covenant, however, cannot be performed with a flint knife. As Paul said, "In him, Christ, you are also circumcised in the putting off of the sinful nature, not with a circumcision done by the hands of men, but with the circumcision done by Christ. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly greed, your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and carnal greed, which is idolatry. Now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips, and do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices." Now, this dude, doctor, is a religious guy. And he brings up the New Testament, and he says, well, the New Testament requires circumcision also. I took a look at the New Testament. I couldn't see any place in the New Testament that abrogated circumcision. I saw some statements in there that might appear that the Gentiles, those that were not Jews, those that were not normally not circumcised, say Chinese people, or some other Gentile group, that they didn't have to be circumcised until they got ready to do the Passover. But you see, Christians don't practice Passover, so Christians don't practice circumcision as a general rule. And I would suspect that this lawyer, Richard W. Morris, probably, while being a Christian, does not practice Passover. Because he doesn't practice Passover, he doesn't want to practice circumcision either. But the statute clearly says that you have to be circumcised in order to practice the Passover. "When a stranger shall sojourn with you and will keep the Passover to the eternal, let all of his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof." That's Exodus 12, verse 48. The Messiah, Jesus, was circumcised. Did you know that? Circumcised on the eighth day. Set us an example that we ought to follow. And then he said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" This guy, Morris, isn't the only guy who's opposed to circumcision. Listen to a letter that I received from a fellow by the name of Russell Zanger. Zanger sent a letter, and he said, "Hi, I hope you had a wonderful trip. It's been a long time since I heard from you, and I missed receiving your letters." He writes a little bit more here in the letter, and then he comes to making some serious statements. For instance, he said, "No baby should be forced to endure another man's religion. They should not be abused because of a bottomless gulf of nonsense. That's why I have been challenging our Christian leaders to preach from the New Testament so as to stop this crime of routine circumcision, but for the most part, they won't even admit that there's anything wrong with being circumcised." That letter is addressed to dear Mr. Gordon, and when I received the letter, I read that and I said, well, gee, I'm circumcised, and I've circumcised my children according to the scripture. And you'll notice here that these people are really opposed to the Old Testament. And I kind of wondered about that, because In Matthew 4, verse 4, and in Luke 4, verse 4, we read a unique statement. The Messiah is saying this, if you had a red-letter Bible. The Messiah, Jesus himself, says in Matthew 4, verse 4, that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Did you know that? He answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread only, or bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Now, one of the words that proceeded out of the mouth of God was this statement in Genesis 17, verses 1 through 27. And when Abraham was 90 years old and 9, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect. And I'll make my covenant between me and you, and I'll multiply you exceedingly. Abraham fell on his face, and he talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. And neither shall your name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. For a father of many nations have I made thee, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I'll make nations of you, and kings shall come out of you, and I'll establish my covenant between me and you, and your seed after you, in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto you, and to your seed after you. And I'll give unto you, and to your seed after you, the land wherein you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. This is a covenant that God made between Abraham and himself and all of Abraham's descendants. For those of us that are descendants of Abraham, it would seem logical to me that we ought to practice this circumcision. And it would also occur to me that any Gentile who wants to participate in this program would also want to be circumcised. Well, assuming that you wanted to do the Passover. You know, Jesus did the Passover. Jesus wasn't a Christian. Jesus didn't practice Easter. Jesus was circumcised. These Christians tell you that no Christian should be circumcised. And I wouldn't disagree with that. It could well be that Christians ought not to be circumcised. But then, if Christians aren't circumcised, what part do they have with the Messiah who said that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, and cited that directly from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, right out of the mouth of Moses, who said man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. This whole subject gets curiouser and curiouser, doesn't it? Well, keep in mind that circumcision prevents penile cancer. It does have a medical benefit, and it ought to be done scripturally on the eighth day. Not the 9th, 10th, or 11th, not the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd. If God wanted it done on any old day, then He wouldn't have told you to do it on the 8th day. Seems simple enough to me. You do it on the 8th day because that's the day that has the least amount of risk. And you do it on the 8th day because that's the day that we were told to do it. And God told us not to add to nor to take away from the law, Deuteronomy 4, verse 2. Don't add to it, don't take away from it. Well, there's a story for you on circumcision, in case you'd never wondered about it. Is there any medical value to it? Now you know that, yes, there is. All right, we're going to have to cut it off right about here. We're just about out of time. Remember, the Law Hour and editorial review is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio logs, our schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed. through the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal, says time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.